All right, so what we'll talk about while these slides are coming up is some of the challenges of influencer marketing. You've heard some of the promise of influencer marketing. We're gonna talk about some of the challenges with influencer marketing and how we tried to solve at least some of them with a launch of Sabra Snackers, which hopefully you've seen the little hummus and guacamole. I always think of Sabra for hummus, but also guacamole packages that you can find in your local convenience store. And we're particularly targeting one geography, which is very tough to do with influencer marketing. We'll talk about that. And we were targeting one sales channel, the drug channel, another way that's difficult to target with ordinary influencer marketing. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenges of influencer marketing, and then Ryan will talk more about the specifics of the Sabra program. So influencer marketing is actually, you know, people say it's the new thing. Well, it's really been around since 2004, if you think about it. Potentially, you could argue earlier than that. And we've got this infographic on our website that you can see all the changes that have happened over all the years of influencer marketing. And if that's helpful to you, feel free to grab it. But even with all that, you know, there's been so many good things. And all the images you see throughout the deck are actual images from carousel campaigns. There's an awful lot of positives in influencer marketing today. So let's talk about a few of those. Number one, we are certainly consuming their content. One piece of research said 19% of total media consumption, including television, including print magazines, total media consumption is influencer-produced content. That may be hard to believe if you're my age, but if you look at my 15-year-old daughter, who's probably at 107% of influencer content produced, she won't watch the TV unless you like kind of force her. So 19% of total media consumption is actually being produced by influencers, and we now know their names, like Logan Paul, and even some who are name-worthy for reasons that aren't bad. Right? So getting their names out there, building businesses, making themselves even into potentially billionaires based on a whole different business model of influence that didn't exist a decade ago. Other good things, marketers are really happy with how influencer marketing's taken them so far. 92% of marketers who've done influencer marketing campaigns say they're effective. That's pretty good. Over half say that the content that influencers are producing for them is outperforming the content they can produce themselves, either in-house or through their agency teams. We find that over and over again when the brands we work with take the influencer content and share it to their social channels, it significantly outperforms what they're able to make themselves. And as a result, budgets are increasing. 39% said they'd increase budgets for influencer marketing in 2018. In fact, that should drive it to over $1 billion in spending on influencer marketing this year. That's a lot of good stuff, a lot of good stuff. But really, influencer marketing, the way it's done so often, is missing the boat on a lot of things. And as a head of an influencer marketing company, it may be a little surprising that I'm gonna kind of crap all over influencer marketing for a minute, but I think we need to be candid about what it can and can't do. So some of the challenges, there's influencers with fake followers or fake engagements, and partly the industry can be to blame. If you incentivize somebody based on the likes they get or based on the reach they get, well, certain people are gonna cheat and they're gonna buy reach, they're gonna buy likes, they're gonna do that. If I can, you know, buy something for a nickel and get paid a dollar, a certain percentage of people are gonna do that. There's no advanced targeting. I'll explain why in a minute on how influencer works and how it's just, it is often spray and pray. And then we let it just end. We let it just end. The influencer talked about our brand. Clap ourselves on the back, ring a little gong. You do that with any of the rest of your marketing? And we don't even know who we're engaging. We got 6,000 likes. Oh, bully for you. Who clicked on those? A link farm in Pakistan? Your ideal customer? Someone in between? Not ideal. And we can't predict or even measure results. And Ryan, I remember the first time you and I talked, you were like, oh good, John scheduled me with another influencer marketing company.
Yeah, so I think it is interesting because as a brand, all influencer marketing now is being looked at with a raised eyebrow. And I think these challenges are really core to that. The first obviously being the one that we've heard many in the industry talk about, which I think brands themselves are at fault for. We're the ones that are chasing after followers, and it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy. But yeah, when we first engaged, it was really interesting because another influencer group, but it turned out to be pretty worthwhile.
All right, thanks. And measuring ROI is the big challenge. 75% of marketers are saying the biggest challenge with influencer marketing is measuring ROI. Now that's often the challenge with with all sorts of marketing, but I think it really jumps out for influencer marketing as a real challenge that people are trying to get to. So why? Well, if you look at how influencer marketing is built today, right? Influencers create content. A lot of platforms have them opt in, so they put out a bid. Anyone want to write about Kleenex? Anyone want to write about Sabra? And people bid on that, right? That can lead to some bottom feeders who bid on everything. So you may or may not get good content, and they may or may not fit what you need to do. They post their content to social, right? They share their blog post, their YouTube video, they create an Instagram story, whatever it is, and you hope. You hope it works. And 92% of marketers are satisfied with the outcome of their influencer marketing programs. So it's not that this doesn't work. It just feels like in an era where everything else in social and digital is hyper-optimized and matched to DMPs and all this cool stuff, that big gap where the orange arrow is, it was ripe for change. So we do it a little bit differently. What we do is, first of all, we're going to hand-pick influencers. And importantly, what we hear a lot is, can you find me a foodie influencer from New York? Well, it's great if that's foodie influencers from New York, but more important is, where's their audience? What's their audience interested in? And is their audience likely to buy from you? And now we have all of our influencers in our platform connected their social channels, so we can actually see where they live, income, all that sort of data aggregated at a level to see if the audience of the influencers are fit. And that's gotta be the first cut. If you get a perfect foodie influencer who for some reason reaches grandma and you're not marketing to grandma, you're way off on the right track. So you've got to find influencers whose audience fits. The second step for us is exactly the same. That's what makes it influencer marketing, right? Share it out to your audience. Where it gets interesting is step three. In step three, we are testing or scoring every single piece of content, every tweet, every Facebook Live video, every blog post, every Instagram. We're both pulling in all the engagement data and we're hand scoring it. Does this meet the brief? Is it FTC compliant? And based on that, we find that even though over here we're handpicking people we know are good content producers, 20% of the content doesn't usually well. We've done 150 of these campaigns. Over and over again, 20% of the content does really well. Which means, for those of you who aren't good at math, 80% of your content does not do unusually well, right? And so if you don't know which 20% is doing really well, you're back to that praying. So I hope you know, you pray. You're iron tight with God there, because that's not the best strategy I've ever heard. So what we do after that is we take that 20% of content and we boost it to the exact right target audience. We can do that about a dozen different ways, but the most popular one is we actually log in with advertiser rights to our influencers' Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest accounts. We boost from them to our target audience, which lets us optimize the content every day, switch them up a link post, we can boost as a carousel post, a Facebook post, we can boost as an Instagram post, and we can see if it's converting whatever to our goal is, and we can optimize every day like a media buy. So now we can reach the exact right target audience. So using that methodology, that's what we applied to Sabra here. And I'll let you finish taking your pictures. Got it? All right. One more. Anyone want to take a picture of me? At Jay Tobin. My wife might check it out. There you go. All right. So I'm going to flip it over to Ryan and take us through what we did for you.
Cool. Great. So first off, show of hands, who here has ever eaten or does eat hummus? All right. That's good. You guys are in the minority. So 70% of the population does not eat hummus. And so I know it's shocking, right? I can come up here and I can always give wonderful speeches about digital stuff and whatever, but I say that 70% of the population does not eat hummus, and everyone's, there's a shock in the crowd. So it's pretty amazing to understand that, and it helps you understand also how much in a bubble we all live. And even more so, and when you look at the New Jersey market, within that are these snackers. So you can see our fun influencer here. She's holding, it's the pretzels and hummus, so if you probably flew here, you've encountered it in the airport as you're looking for real food. The big thing about our snackers is that we have even less of the population consumes those. So about 20 to 30% of our current buyers consume the snackers. So we have a challenge here. Now, Sabra was born in Astoria, Queens, right? We're from New York. So for us to not be able to have the New York market is something that's near and dear to our heart, right? To make sure that we're growing the New York market as much as possible. But it's a challenging market from a grocery standpoint because grocery stores are not your average grocery store here in the city. So what we needed to do was tap into a different group of people and make sure that we're really elevating both the brand of hummus, but also to help the brand of Sabra itself and the category of hummus, but to let them also understand the portability aspect, that you can eat this on the go, you can actually have real food on the go. It's crazy. So first thing was education. That was the number one priority there. And then after that, we wanted to reach and engage. Now, we had a very specific kind of audience that we were talking to. Your 18 to 44 is not very specific. We got a lot more specific from there. So let's continue with looking into this. So what we first did was go through, as we talked about in the process before, of the hand-selected influencers. We chose, and we're very, very careful to choose the type of content they were looking for. We didn't look at followers. We looked at style. We looked at content. We looked at the type of person and the type of message that they were doing, because when you're doing influencer marketing, you're actually utilizing the brand of the influencer and not your own brand. And so as a result, you need to adapt as your brand into what their equity is. And so we wanted to make sure that our equity and their equity was aligning very, very well. So you can see we have a food muse, we have Life Tailored, and a whole bunch of others that really brought together this young urbanite millennial mindset, but for what we call is the experience seeker. So the experience seeker is somebody who's looking to explore and find new foods, find new opportunities to explore their own tastes, and they're looking exactly for those experiences. It's pretty self-explanatory. So as we continue through that, there was a whole lot of content creation and sharing. Some of it was Instagram stories, some of it was, we really focused on Instagram here, and it was because of who we wanted to tap into and how we wanted to position Sabra. We want to make sure that Sabra is seen as being a cool brand, because it is a cool brand, right? So we want to make sure that it's part of that, and so we want to make sure that we're publishing on the types of channels that are the newest and the more up-to-date. So we really focused a lot on Instagram stories, and a bunch of other, and the content creation and sharing happened. But then from there, we came through the process of the test and score, right? For us to understand the type of content that resonated within that audience, to help us indicate, this is an early indicator that this type of content will be successful. So in a traditional brand marketing standpoint, this is your creative testing. This is your phase when you go out there and you creative test and think about each of their followers as focus groups, right? So each of the influencer followers, it's a focus group, and when we publish out there, we're testing within that focus group to see if that content is actually good before we go ahead and boost it.
If I could just jump in for a second. So social media is a little different than every other kind of paid advertising. If you buy a banner ad and your creative is amazing, you pay the same price per impression than if your banner ad is terrible. Same for print magazines, same for TV. Social, you pay less if you have good creative. That's unique and different, right? So we have to know which pieces are going to do the best so we can get efficiencies with that optimization. Somebody yesterday said organic reach is dead. Any Princess Bride fans? It's only mostly dead. And if you know the difference, you can know that that organic is sending off signals as to what's going to do well when it's paid.
So as we're looking at the hand-selected influencers here, one of the interesting things is understanding of their...
I thought a UFO was taking off.
Okay, this may interrupt. Yes, exactly. It's hummus time. So I'm going to try to talk through that and see if we have to evacuate. So so we have 70%. What's interesting here is that we're looking at the audience for these two influencers. And you can see their actual audience resides within New York City, which is awesome. Within that New York DMA area, it's a really high growth, like that's a high portion of their population living in New York City. The total population of New York City, I think, is what,
6%? That's
6% of the U.S. So if we have 30%, that's a pretty good concentration. Curious as to what's going on. So then we went into this idea of advanced geo-targeting. So while they may be publishing from New York, it doesn't necessarily mean that their followers are in New York.
They're checking.
They're checking. That's good. We're all safe.
There's going to be a little personality test here. Yeah, for exactly. Who leaves?
Focus.
Who's a little more reckless?
So what's interesting here is now you can see on the right-hand side, you can see actually where the targeting happened, right? So while the influencers may be based in New York City, it doesn't mean their followers are based in New York City. We can have a lot of influencers like based out of Ontario that'll have a lot of followers in New York City. So it doesn't make a difference. And a lot of times when you look at influencer marketing, it gets so rudimentary that they're like, this influencer happens to be in New York City, so you're targeting New York City. It doesn't work that way.
We're okay. It really was the hummus.
It was, okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
there's jokes to go on in there. But so what we did is we took the media dollars that we put behind it. Once we tested, once we understood what the content was, we then focused those dollars within the New York City area, right? With the clear call to action to get it at your local drugstore, right? Because New York City, most people go shopping in, you know, you have some grocery stores, but mostly it's, you know, your grocery shopping consists of getting Seamless. I mean, that's a grocery shop. You know, but a lot of times also it means going to Duane Reade or going to, you know, Rite Aid or Walgreens and grabbing something real quick to go, right? And so in this case, we wanted to see a lift in sales within these types of drugstore environments. And so we had a clear call to actions for each of our influencers to drive consumers to the drugstore and then focus the media behind that in the New York City area. There you go. So targets include not just New York City area, but also what are their interests, what's the type of media that they're consuming, retailers, the types of retailers that we're targeting there, and then ultimately, what are the behaviors, right? Are they healthy? Because we're not going to go after influencers that are not healthy, because it's hummus, but we're going to also go after within that area, within that realm. So fashion tends to be in that realm. Other areas tend to be in that realm, and so that's what we really looked at. So as we saw before, the influencers having about 30% of their reach in New York City, that is impressive, but that means that there's 70% waste, right? That's the math again. So looking back at that, what we wanted to do is turn that 70% waste to zero. And by using paid media behind the influencer posts, we're able to now, it opens up a whole lot of performance tracking, a whole lot of insights, and it also helps guarantee that the waste isn't there because we're not wholly dependent on just the organic placement. We're using our dollars to laser focus and hyper target. All right, so here you can see the users in the New York DMA follow fashion, beauty, etc. They're most cost efficient. Over 75% of all link clicks came from users 18 to 34. Women ages 18 to 34 were the most engaged, garnering 66% of post reactions. A lot of this data you wouldn't be able to get if you're not boosting it, if you're not putting the paid dollars behind it. And the community loved it. That's the key thing. Honestly, for us, honestly, to make sure that we're generating that excitement, that's the best part, but that's part of the targeting. That's making sure that we're getting in front of the right people. You're really looking at two different issues when it comes to influencer marketing. One is targeting and one is measurement. If you don't have targeting nailed, then fake followers is within that realm of targeting. Because if I'm talking to bots or talking to people outside of the US where you can't buy our product, then there's waste, right? So you have to nail the targeting, but then the measurement has to be there, and it can't be share of voice. It can't be, oh, we got more social mentions, because I know I can game that. I can game Crimson Hexagon all day long when it comes to getting tweets to generate and make a big pop. I know how to make that happen. I don't want to make that happen. My goal is not to generate more noise. My goal is to sell more product. So we have to get more efficient and more effective and be realistic about it. And I think it's honestly, this is an inflection point for the influencer marketing industry in general. The community response is awesome. We love these, but this is an output of that targeting. And then the effectiveness for us is an output of the measurement. So even the reactions came from the right people. Those women 18 to 34 were the most engaged. That's exactly what we wanted. So here's the total results. Right? Well, the ones that we can share. So overall, we reached above our goal of impressions. We had an estimated number of goal of impressions. You were able to do that by backing into it with a CPM. We were able to actually do real math and not just measure how much of a reaction do we think we're going to get out of this. There's not a lot of, you know, there's no spray and pray here. It's very, very laser focused. The equivalent media cost ended up being 1.4 times higher. Engagements 113% above the benchmark, 56 pieces of unique content. That content value was over $10,000, and it reached the right target, and that's what's the most important. Now, we have, there's a whole lot of other data that I can't share with you, but let me just tell you it was positive.
And the one that's missing off this slide is sales, yep. Obviously. So I took two other examples of programs we've done where we could measure sales using this same methodology. So this is a brand, I've taken the brand's name off of here, but this brand was introducing meal kits in Texas only. And so what they did is say, all right, if you can constrain influencer marketing to a given market, you take Dallas. And we'll do everything else the same throughout all of Texas, including Dallas. We'll just layer in influencer and see if there's any difference in sales between Dallas and the rest of Texas. Well, the way we did this, we could not only get the influencer content, but we could make sure it was being boosted between 3 and 6 o'clock at night when people were saying, oh, I don't have anything for dinner. And as a result of that, we had 47% better sales in Dallas than they did in the rest of Texas. The other one relative to the drug channel that I can share is this one with Revlon with mascara. So this is a nice one. This is another way to do measurement when it's difficult, right? Is can you find a good benchmark to compare it to? So in this one, we had Revlon, who had done a BOGO, buy one, get one, offer at Walgreens 3 months earlier on the same product line, these mascara things, brushes, right? And I learned when I was the only male at a meeting at Revlon that apparently it's a thing to use more than one brush style to get a given look. So we created a campaign called Mascara Mixology, where we did mascara cocktailing, and we showed people how to do that, we being people who know what they're doing, and we did all this sort of content. The nice part about having a benchmark when it's on the same product, at the same retailer, the same offer value, even on the same day of the week, it was a Sunday that you had to get the BOGO. We had a really clean benchmark, and so we did this whole program compressed into 9 days, influencer content posting, analyzing the content, boosting it heavy up leading up to that Sunday of sales. We moved 209% more units than they did the last time they did the same offer on the same product at the same retailer. So if you can inspire people, you can create inspirational, aspirational content and get it in front of the right people, they tend to buy at a much higher rate than other ways of marketing, is what I found. So finally, what Sabra, I think, did with this program, they're very clear. New York, New Jersey, drug channel, adventure seekers. Yep. The best content in real time, figuring out what it was. Targeting the content both geographically and demographically, and I'd even argue psychographically. So getting to the right people in the mindset, the kind of person who eats hummus, because apparently 70% of the country is lunatics who don't eat hummus. And they got the perpetual license to use this content. And not only that, they know which pieces perform the best, all the way down to which pieces perform the worst. So when they go to share this on their social channels, it's already been pre-tested. And this was a pilot, proved out a model for future activations, I hope. So that we can make sure this is the kind of thing that works and takes some of the potential for BS and influencer marketing and addresses it head on and tries to work around it. So with that, I think we have time for a question or two, Mike.
Yeah. Jim, or Ryan, a lot of them right up here. Excellent.
Hi, I'm not from here. I'm from Paris, flying over here to take part in this conference, and I love it so far, really. I would like to have some question about the index that you use to rank the influencers. How do you calculate these index? Like, what are the criteria underlying?
Yeah.
What are the, just like some bullet points, how to calculate that?
Sure. It's an algorithm that factors in engagement, virality, content quality. I feel like there's one other piece. But so it's a mix of data we're pulling out of the APIs from the social channels, the raw numbers. And then our team, as they look at the content, they score it on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being a really blurry image or an image that maybe doesn't include the brand at all, but it was in a blog post and it was setting up the story. That's going to be scale 1. A 5 is, this is a picture we know is perfect. It's right on the brief. They're going to want to use this again. So there's both the qualitative and the quantitative, and then the algorithm puts weight on all those and ranks the content.
Okay, so is ranked manually by your team?
The hand scoring is manual. Yeah. The rest of it comes in automatically.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. And another question, if you don't mind. Because I'm working for a big corporation in insurance, so like the board members always look at the sales, mm-hmm. look at the revenue, and currently we are doing influencer marketing just in a few local markets, not everywhere in the world, but we are struggling in how to measure it, how to put it in money, like to have a report to the board member. Like,
yeah. Right. So the question is struggling to measure it in the insurance industry is what.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think the way I look at this all the time is when, because I've been doing social media since 2007. And so when somebody comes to me and says, I'm struggling measuring social media, or I'm struggling measuring influencer marketing, my first question to them is, how are you measuring everything else? So I worked as the social agency of record for Chrysler Group for 5 years. And they said, how do we know that social sells cars? And I said, how do you know that TV sells cars? Legitimate question. How do you know that print ads sell cars? And I asked them, how do you know that your digital's selling cars? And what they did is they came back and said, we don't really know because the dealers sell cars. But what we're trying to drive to and what we are measuring is what we call lower funnel activities. How many people click on build a car, schedule a test drive, those things that indicate they might want to buy a car. So we said, okay, that's your measure of success. Let's go look at what social contributed to that. How many LFAs, lower funnel activities, did social contribute? And at what cost relative, so if you're spending $50 million to generate this number of LFAs and you're spending $1 million on social to generate this many LFAs, which one's more efficient? So that doesn't answer your specific question, but it's the way for anyone in this business that if you're asked how do you measure it, the immediate question is how do you measure everything else? And if the answer is we don't, then you say, well, shut the hell up. And if the answer is, well, we do it this way, then okay, how can I get really close to what you value and tell you how we're impacting that? And maybe how can I change what I'm doing in social to drive those things? Because measuring through to sales, really hard in almost every business.
And part of it is also setting up a test cell for yourself. So we were very specific as to where the geographic market should be for reasons. We have the historical sales data for that market. So we're able to provide and understand the seasonality of sales and then be able to see, hey, what's the lift, right? And what's the lift of those specific channels that we drove to versus prior years or versus other comparable channels? And you can set up a test and control market. Because we figured this stuff out for all other advertising. There's no reason why we can't figure it out for digital.
Do you work well with your sales colleague?
I'm sorry?
Do you work well with your sales colleague?
It was, like, sales were part of it. It wasn't exactly the normal sales studies that I'm more used to at a more grander scale, mm-hmm. because those often are a little bit more spray and pray, but also those have a very big nationwide kind of approach, and so a lot of times what you need to do is you need to find that statistical significance and find pockets of people that you're able to measure the data from. So to focus in the New York City, New Jersey area, this helped us hone in on specific channels, specific markets, and then we were able to do that kind of test and control.
And that gets to price. We can actually measure on our influencer campaigns a test and control audience and what percentage lift we had of people walking into a given retailer that saw the content and didn't see the content. As long as your campaign budget's at least $400,000.
At least.
So the question is it worth it to know that answer or not? So that's the balancing act.
More expensive for your
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you. Forgive me if you went through this. I might have missed it in the steps you were showing. Once you've, in your attempt to shrink your waste from 70% down to zero, and you actually found the actual targets that the influencers unpacked for you, and you then focused in on those specific targets, what content did you repackage back to them? Was it the same content they'd already seen, or did you produce new content?
So it's the same content the influencers produced, shared to a wider audience. So their initial audience is the focus group to tell us which content is the best, and then we boost that high-performing content beyond their initial reach to new audiences. We're also measuring who's clicking through the content, and we're building a lookalike audience of the engaged audience, and we're boosting to them as well. So we work for a large e-commerce retailer that you may have heard of, and that was the highest converting group of all. Find people who click and then target that influencer content to the lookalike audience, and they're very likely to convert. So we're getting the influencers like this because we're getting them you know, they've got an audience and we're saying, hey, can we use our money to get your a wider audience with your content? The answer is generally yes.
Hi, this is great, thanks very much. I'm wondering, with regard to the Sabre campaign where you incorporated Duane Reade and with the Mascara campaign where you incorporated Walmart, did those external retailers help the brand fund the campaign? Like, did they contribute financially? And is that a model that you use often?
So it's different. Sabra paid for this campaign and targeted the drug channel broadly, and Revlon paid for the Walgreens campaign. So it varies. There's shopper marketing teams that often fund from the brands that often fund sales at different retailers, and we often work with shopper marketing teams. In this case, it was the brand.
Yeah, when you have a manufacturer focusing in on a specific retailer, 9 times out of 10, maybe 10 out of 10, right? The retailer's not paying for that, right? But what you're trying to do as a manufacturer, we're fresh food, so I don't have the beauty of selling something online and being able to see the click stream and optimize and all these wonderful things that you know other. I'm jealous of other marketers to be able to do that, right? Because we're refrigerated, and refrigerated means a much smaller kind of footprint to be able to distribute things. But what we depend on is sales coming from the retail channels. And so it's kind of a proxy for us to make sure that we're funneling into a specific retailer to help then understand what's the lift in that retailer. That helps us prove it out and then scale that across other retailers. So it's almost 9 times out of 10, I would say retailers are not involved. Shopper marketing is really what we focus on, which is getting shoppers to convert. But then from there, there's also an awareness and an education. That's more your upper funnel type stuff. So it's a whole mixture of different things, but I wish retailers would pay for it.
Hi, my name is Carlisle. I'm with Smile Direct Club. We just did a really big brand awareness influencer play for World Smile Day. And we worked with about 80 influencers, and I would say like 65 of them performed really well. They had really good content. They were really engaged. But like 15 didn't at all. So how do you hold influencers accountable for the content they agree to produce for you after the campaign's already run?
There's a couple things. Number one, we pay upon completion. So if they actually don't do the work, they don't get paid. So that's pretty effective. But number two is we go in every campaign assuming there's going to be a spectrum of performance. So we do a lot of work for Jared, the Gallery of Jewelry. And we have another algorithm called iStack, which actually ranks each influencer performance over the campaign, takes those same criteria that we measure content by, bubbles it up to the influencer level, and then factors in the cost of each influencer, so there's an efficiency measure. And then at the end of, let's say for Jared, we finish Valentine's Day, we can say, okay, we use 17 influencers, here's the bottom 8 or whatever, thank you, here's your payments, you did your work. These top 10, would you like to do the Mother's Day program we have? Because you're doing really well. And over 12 months with Jared, we were able to drop the cost per engagement by 65%. Jared also doesn't sell online. It's very hard to track back a social post to a ring or earrings or something. But we were able to get a lot of efficiency by optimizing influencers along the way. So I think if you start with the expectation they're not gonna all hit home runs, and how are we gonna know which content's a home run, and how are we gonna know which influencers are home run, and just make sure you have a path to measure that, and then just re-engage the ones. We also find when we re-engage the same influencers for the same brand, engagement rate goes way up.
Yeah, and just to add on to that one, the best thing, I mean, so I wish we were more, you know, detailed and had that level of complexity to it, but I would say the simple thing is for influencers that don't perform, we don't work with, right? And so the influencers that are in it for the short game of saying they're gonna get easy, quick money, and they're gonna get one post, they may be successful for that, but they're not gonna be a repeated success. They're not gonna make a career out of it. Influencers wanna make a career out of it. This is their passion. They've worked to grow their audience. They're the gatekeepers of their audience, and so we as brands need to be respectful of that. At the same time, they need to be respectful of the fact that we have a request for them and that we're trying to run a business. So if they're not gonna perform, we're not gonna work with them again, and those that do perform begin to see the benefits over time and can really make a amazing career out of it as long as they keep their priorities in order.
Other question. We have 50,000 influencers in our database, so I mean, we respect the ones that are really good, and the ones that aren't, there's another one. So if you're great, a lot of respect, we're going to give you a lot of money. We're going to pay you quickly and consistently, but If not, there's somebody else hustling trying to make it. And because we're manufacturing the reach afterwards, we can get more reach from an influencer with 20,000 followers than an influencer with 200,000 followers if the content's better. Because we're deciding the ultimate reach of the content. So we're looking at content quality, engagement rates, those sort of things.
Maybe I'll ask a last question on behalf of the unsexy B2B brands that are out here. Jim, where does influencer marketing fit for B2B? What kind of things have you done, and how can a B2B marketer look at this for relevancy?
Yeah, so what we, Carousel is only B2C. My other company, Ignite Social Media, does B2B. And with B2B influencer, it's a lot more patient and a lot smaller, typically. You know, you don't typically find, you know, 30 influencers who can write about this kind of engine, right, and then aggregate all their content, right? There's not that sort of volume. So you may be dealing with 1, 3, 5 influencers who are credible in the space, and it's a much more patient, I would think, ambassador strategy that they are consistently with you, consistently producing content. You're looking for ways to boost them. They're looking for ways to boost you, and sort of rising tides. This methodology was specifically built for B2C brands, which is why we end up with brands like Sabra and Revlon and Jared the Galleria. But so influencer, I haven't figured this out for B2B, so I have to just say no to people who approach us on the B2B side. But there is a whole different sort of strategy. And I think the important thing is A, being more patient, and B, but also setting expectations of what success looks like before you start. I think that's the only way to make sure everybody's on the same page as to what you're trying to drive to.
You know, it's interesting thinking, and your book from 2007 was called what?
Social Media is a Cocktail Party.
Social Media is a Cocktail Party. I mean, that maybe from the B2B side is more about, you know, somebody goes to a networking event and I'm telling other people about an advertising agency I used or a consultant I used or an accounting software that we brought in, and figure out what that model translates to online, because that's how that influence happens, it seems like, offline.
Yeah, the philosophy, so much has changed since 2007. There were no Facebook fan pages, there were no advertising options, but the philosophy of adding value hasn't changed since I wrote that book. You can probably safely skip the chapter on Second Life, but otherwise.
But still good stuff there, and great stuff today. So let's have a big round of applause for Jim and Ryan. Thank you so much.